You're listening to the Limitless, the podcast between, and this week I'm talking once again to Sam Hyde.
I mean, so where, you know, have you finished your book or you're almost done?
It's finished. I'm just adding a little bit of extra context. So, and particularly this book I've just read, The Power of Ritual in Prehistory.
Oh boy.
Which is here. And you just reminded me of it when you were speaking, because you can't see it because
I can't see it.
There it is.
The creepy mask.
Funny technological interference again. Yeah, you reminded me of it because you're talking about the cult-like qualities in Los Angeles. Well, there's a lot of correlations that I found in this book, in the description of secret societies, including specifically on the West Coast, specifically in California. He has a chapter on California, talking prehistorical now, so as far back as it goes. Their practices and he calls it trans-egalitarian societies, and how secret societies were geared towards self-interest, the aggrandizers, as he calls them, and that they used terror and spectacle, and that they created these amazing shows and to get the public kind of not the public but the rest of the community to be aware of the secret societies and to see them, because they weren't, the societies themselves were not secret. It was what they knew that was secret.
Right. It was the mysteries, not the society itself.
Exactly. So it's similar today with the Masons as an obvious go-to. Like, there's nothing secret about the existence of the Masons, but the
right
what they actually know and do is unknown. So there's definitely secrecy around it. They don't have public spectacles, as far as I know, but these ancient secret societies across the world generally did, and so
it was like early PR for the society.
Yeah, it was a form of advertising, that's right, and they involved dancing, primarily performance, mask work. So you could say that's also the origin of theater, which makes it the origin of movies. So I think there's a pretty strong case to be made for Hollywood as a secret society in this ancient tradition that hasn't, there's no, like he's calling it, his thesis is it's the missing link between religion and politics. Why it is that all political systems seem to have had a very strong religious kind of formative influence, or that they tended to political socio-political movements or developments seem to crystallize around religious beliefs and whatnot. He's saying that the secret societies are the missing link there, because secret societies have consciously and knowingly and covertly organized society towards their own interests and created political organizations and so on and so forth.
Right. That's it. See, I've read the opposite. Which isn't to say both aren't true,
mm-hmm.
which is that, you know, the speculation that theater started within initiations itself, so that like they would reveal a mystery to someone that they were initiating by recreating the drama of like the creation or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and that was like the first theater, was these sort of like smoke and screen magic theater tricks where they would scare their initiate and dramatize a myth, and then it slowly got out of the initiation and became more public.
I see. Well, I mean, we don't know about what was going on privately.
Right.
That's the point. But we do know that they were doing it publicly.
Right.
But something. But not obviously not the same thing. Like, that was the whole point, is you enter the secret society, then you start to have the different experiences that aren't available to the public and different privileges and so on. And I think I think it's reasonable to say the same is true of Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood is a place, it's a location, but it's also a community, it's also a kind of institution, it's also a kind of organization. People go there because of the spectacle and the advertising, and they go there for the spectacle, but they also go there because they want to have access to it. But actually getting access to it, which, you know, includes all of these privileges, and then you also discover, you know, you don't actually know all of what the privileges are. You can guess, and some of it is advertised, but other aspects are not.
Right, you also don't know all the costs either.
That's right, you don't know, that's right. And that was central to secret societies, was that, and not just the initiation rituals, but actual literal money. Like, you had to have a lot of money to go up, you know, the ladder in secret societies, prehistorically speaking. The wealth was very central to that.
Right, right. Like, it's always been out of the ruling class. These aren't,
yeah,
these aren't proletariat traditions.
No. No. So,
as long as it's been, I mean, like, this is, you know, 5,000 years ago is the same deal, right? I mean, it was, these weren't happening from the field workers. This was happening from the royalty and the landowners and the, you know, the wealth of the society.
Yeah, although it's a bit circular, isn't it? Because that's also how those individuals established and maintained their ruling class status. But sure, like, it's a means of establishing and maintaining control, and it does require some sort of appearance of a public service. The secret societies do appear to be providing something necessary. One of the central things was sort of original protection racket, which is that the secret societies are shamanic, they're sorcery based, and that those who belong to them, particularly the higher levels, have access to the spiritual realms, including the realm of the stars, rather symmetrically speaking.
Right.
They even believe that they became stars when they died, so that's a direct match with the Hollywood myth, but they were necessary intermediaries between the ordinary people and the gods, or the invisible realms, or the entities, or the, you know, animal spirits and ancestral spirits. So if there are any kind of, because there were, you know, there were elements of threat and danger that the invisible world represented, so the ordinary people needed the shaman class to protect them from those forces. But then, of course, they also had the power to wield those forces in a way that would be threatening to the people. So that's the protection racket is, you need protection from us, the gangsters, but you also need protection from us, the gangsters, if you see what I mean. We will protect you from ourselves, basically.
Right, right. Right? That's, yes, yes. But, and I mean, it's, you know, the deeper I look into sort of esotericism and occultism, it really is a thin line between, it's just all religion. It's just different models of it, right? I mean, and I guess if you subscribe to it, that's a more, like, controversial statement to make, but
it is. I mean, it's all invisible realms,
right?
And
it's all even shared. Like, they share a lot of the same, like, building blocks of those invisible realms. You know, it's not like they're totally different mythologies either.
No, they definitely overlap. But how much is occultism a counterfeit of religion, and how much is religion simply a consolidation of occultism, if you see what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Organized religions, that's a consolidation of power based on occult principles, or something like that. But the central idea is that they come from divine revelation, which isn't really... occultism is much more democratic in that regard, as in yes. anyone can have their particular revelation, and the occult belief systems tend to have lots of their polytheistic pantheon. They have a pantheon of forces and deities, just as the shamanic thing had lots of spirits and ancestors and all the rest of it, rather than one god and so on. So certainly religion is claiming to be something more than occultism. And
But isn't occultism occultism's making those same claims in its own terms, but
it's claiming to represent truth, certainly,
right,
but not necessarily access to the one god. And the main difference, I would say, but this is going to be blurry because it's one thing, one can say something and not practice it, but it's between surrender and will. So occultism is much more, and shamanism is much more about doing stuff in order to collaborate with and or placate the forces, the invisible forces, whereas the religious doctrines, most of them anyway, certainly the Judeo-Christian Islamic, the big three are about surrender too. They're passive, they're about worship. So that's a really central difference.
I think that's a good clear distinction that you make.
But it is a bit blurry, isn't it? Because the priesthood in organized religion, they are doing practices and they are using will and they are accumulating power. So you could say that they are practitioners right. of the occult, who are using religious doctrine as a cover for their own political machinations, which is his thesis there. So really the big, the question that's left unanswered is there a one God? Is there a kernel of truth in there that both religions that are organized and occultism as a methodology are distortions of?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's how did you like your talk with Carl? Was that helpful for you? After reading his book?
It was somewhat helpful. It wasn't, the reception wasn't great, and we didn't have very much time, so I didn't feel we could really get into the meat of a conversation right. so much as just kind of finding out where each other was at. Yeah, what was your impression?
I agree with that. Like, I was glad you started getting to what I shared with you, that the crux of it for me was just his describing like what he called aesthetic terrorism and sort of that thread of it was the most interesting to me, more than the case studies. For sure. I mean, he's and the whole story of it was interesting to me. You had sent me that chapter, which was definitely the most engaging chapter for me, but there was a couple other chapters I liked like that. And then I looked him up in the book and the book had all this like negative press about it, that it was just satanic scare. And that didn't, from that chapter, it didn't make any sense to me that they were calling it that, because it was clearly like, intellectual and academic, with at least that chapter of it was.
Yeah.
And then I looked him up and he's like, a structuralist philosopher that helped one of the people, early discoverers of Derrida. And I'm like, well, something isn't adding up here. But then reading the whole book, I can see where, some of the case study pivots, some of his belief structures like kind of bleed in a little bit, even though he was trying to be objective, which, like jumping from D&D to like abducted girls for child pornography is a pretty big leap.
I felt that too. It was partly why I asked him if he's a Christian at the end, because it felt like that he was taking an ideological position, not in obvious ways, but just in how easily he did go to joining dots there. And
yeah,
I wanted to get into that with him, and I started to when I said, well, how do you separate Satanism from culture at large? And he agreed that you can't. So then where does that leave us? I mean, you can't just say that Dungeons and Dragons is a delivery device for satanic principles, and that's all it is. It's not like that. It's not like there's this thing outside of culture that's then infiltrating culture and using these satanic Trojan horses. It's not that simple, is it?
That's right.
Right.
And part of, you know, I wish, like, the chapters I enjoyed the most were the ones that were the most academic. And I kind of wish that he had just theorized for the whole book, because the 40 pages of theorizing he did were really interesting, or whatever. I mean, I made up that number, but it was something like that, you know, like, and you know, and I'm hungry for that perspective, because I find there to be a lack. I don't find a lot of material that kind of looks at the phenomenon that isn't just sort of, you know, drinking the occult Kool-Aid. Or on the flip, just being totally religious and, you know, pointing a finger at it and not seeing any nuance to it. There's not a lot of people trying to analyze it from the middle. But it keeps coming up, you know, like you know, you guys said it, especially from like the Western framework, it is just so woven. The mythology is so woven into culture. It's just wild. And you know, it's hard to get a grasp of what to even make of that.
Yeah, and he's definitely, I mean, that material in that chapter definitely helped me to get to grips with something around that. And I thought just that one chapter, The Aesthetics of Terror, I think it was called.
Yeah.
If that had been expanded into a book, it would have been a way more interesting book, and I wish he would write it.
I agree.
'Cause that was... And even there, you know, because it was just one chapter, he was joining dots too quickly, I felt, and not enough nuance, because, you know, Bataille and Artaud, and, I mean, I know people now, like John Cousins, and he knows people who are into these cultural influences and see them as positive, even though they're not necessarily unaware of the dark. I mean, you can't not be aware of the dark side of those things, because they are dark. It's not that they have a dark side, they are dark, but there's a dark side even to the dark, right?
Yes.
So I'm not sure they're aware of the dark side. It's a bit like the Jimmy Savile thing, you know, if you put the weird stuff front and center, people assume that that's as dark as it gets, but actually, but it's difficult to know, like, is it there intentionally in the philosophy and in the methodology, or are they simply, like with D&D, I mean, that's a really easy go-to example. I think it's pretty likely, I never got into D&D, but that for every one person who got sort of satanically colonized by D&D, as in it hooked into something, some trauma implant in them, and magnified it so that they became possessed and became Damien Eccles or whatever, there's going to be 99 who, you know, just found some way to be less alienated and to tap into some archetypal stuff that was a bit scary. And yeah, maybe it you know, had some negative things, just like watching horror movies does, but it didn't lead them into, you know, killing cats or anything, and potentially it led them into a deeper understanding of the culture and a familiarity with it, which wasn't just contamination, right?
Yeah, and potentially help people unlock imagination, you know, like if you're young and want to know how to write, it helps to be able to imagine a world, you know.
That's an interesting point, because right there we could look at that, couldn't we? Because if, you know, the key that unlocks your imagination might very well influence the way that you use your imagination. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Like I was, my imagination was unlocked by movies, and now I can't disentangle it from movies.
Yeah.
So it's like my imagination's been co-opted. So, and I think that is a subtler thing, where one could say, well, all culture is bad, and one wouldn't entirely be wrong. It's just, as you were saying at the start, it's a bit unrealistic, because then you just end up wanting zombies to take over the world, just to, you know, because we don't have a alternative to culture that we can, you know, really experience short of going native. But still, I think there is an argument to be made that any kind of cultural allegiance comes at a cost.
Yeah. But, I mean, everything in the universe seems to come with a cost, right? I mean, there's also that sort of Zen-like balance thing where you gain something, you lose something.
So this would be where we'd get the possible invisible bridge between occultism and organized religion and true spirituality, if that's not an oxymoron,
right.
Where something that doesn't require sacrifice. I mean, it's complicated because there's a positive kind of sacrifice. It doesn't require blood sacrifice, let's put it that way.
But does all occultism boil down require blood sacrifice?
I think
a debate in itself.
I think it does. I think it does. Yeah, yeah. And religion too. Like it's there in the Old Testament. I mean,
there's certainly been a lot of blood behind religion.
Yeah, like, yeah, there's no doubt.
Arguably, the most blood, you know, of anything has gone behind.
I think it's the hidden, you know, it's René Girard again. We're going to end up at René Girard, aren't we? The hidden function of the sacred.
What is the hidden function of the sacred?
Is sacrifice. Is blood sacrifice.
Right? God, it's so dark.
Yeah.
There's still some pieces of you in the fridge. There's still some pieces of you down on the floor. There's no technique yet for cloning yourself. That's what she said as I cleaned some more. She gave me no choice but to cut her in half. The rules of engagement were meant to last. I needed much more than she was able to give.
Is it, what, how do you escape that? Or is there no escape, right? I guess that's one of the big questions.
Well, that's the invisible bridge, right? I don't know if that's the right good analogy, because that sounds like Scientology, doesn't it? The bridge to infinity. But as in, well, the religious principle of surrender, which is consistent through these three main religions, even though that as
Abraham, yeah,
even though they have blood sacrifice in them as well.
And I would say that, you know, and indigenous, you know, traditions all have surrender as an important component in their spirituality, it seems like. I mean, I think it goes beyond the Abrahamic religions.
Sure, as a principle. I mean, that's a good place to go to, isn't it?
Because I think in animism there's plenty of surrender, you know.
Well, I was just going to say that it can't be an ideology is the thing. Like you've got the Judeo-Christian thing, and they promote surrender, but they practice blood sacrifice. So again, all of these things, it doesn't matter what they're promoting. If they're aspiring to transcendence, then underneath it, and this includes Hollywood, back to Hollywood, that's the kind of transcendence, there's this hidden secret societal ritual aspect of blood sacrifice, I think.
Yeah.
So then...
let me ask you this, sorry. Yeah. What is your take on just ritual as a concept?
Is it possible to avoid ritual?
Well, what even is ritual?
Exactly.
And is it possible? And then is it possible to avoid it?
Because routine is a kind of ritual. Like if I brush my teeth the same way every morning at the same time, that becomes a ritual. It just doesn't have any pretensions to transcendence.
Right.
So, but you mean particularly religious ritual, as in ones that are...
Well, I wouldn't say religious specifically, because I would include a cult ritual as well, which I guess is all sort of wanting to connect to a spiritual world, right? Through...
To make the invisible visible or experiential, to have an experience of something that we can't access directly, perhaps. And I think Yeah, so my take on ritual in that sense is it's self-contradictory, or it goes against the spirit of surrender, which is that God has to come to us. We can't go to God. And yet, we've got to show that we're willing. So how do you show you're willing? I mean, a ritual could also just be that. There could be a surrender ritual.
Right. Yeah, are you familiar with... Joseph Campbell's definition?
No.
He says, a ritual is the enactment of a myth. And since myth is a projection of the depth wisdom of the psyche, by participating in a ritual, participating in the myth, you are being, as it were, put in accord with that wisdom, which is the wisdom that is inherent with you anyhow.
Right.
He connects it, so he thinks it's dramatizing myth, which kind of goes back to Hollywood too, again, in a way.
It does, yeah. Absolutely.
I don't know that I agree with that definition. It was interesting to me, though.
Well, it's definition of a ritual. It's not the definition of a transcendence, is it?
No, right.
So it could be regarded as neutral. I mean, we know it's Joseph Campbell, so he's promoting the power of myth, literally. But... we don't have to read it that way. Like, it could be accurate, and we could still say, well, I don't think that's what I want, right? I don't want to access wisdom by channeling archetypal energies. I just want to access wisdom by, as you know, by chopping water and carrying wood. And I always get that wrong. I always get that flipped around. You don't chop water, do you? I guess that says something about how foreign it is to me just to... To do those things, I mean,
to simplify it and get down to those basics.
Well, yeah, and I don't actually chop wood or carry water, so no wonder I always fudge it, because I don't do those things. I was going to say sorting, you know, women's clothing, but that might sound a bit confusing to listeners if they don't know the connection there. But as
if they don't know, you run a secondhand clothing shop.
Exactly. So, but to take out the element of will in relation to transcendence, as in the will to transcend, I personally believe, it's contradictory, it's storming heaven, and I personally believe that's why it always ends up with violent rituals of violence. somehow. Yeah. Because you can't do it, so you keep trying more and more and more.
Yeah, but I do believe there are rituals don't inevitably have to lead to violence.
Well, the use of will to transcend will either lead to giving up, surrender, or to violence.
Right.
Because you're not going to transcend through will, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that's right. And I guess that's a big problem at the root of a lot of occultism.
Yeah.
Right. Is that will to power?
Yeah.
Where certainly, and not, this isn't even coming from a religious point of view, but any times I've felt like I've become liminal or started like tapping the other side, has 100% been from surrender, not from a will.
Right.
And that just sort of is when it's happened organically, you know, but that's an interesting, I think that's an interesting distinction that you're sort of fleshing out between the two, you know, between two ways of sort of transcendence, that, you know, that will to it versus that surrender to it.
And I think, you know, it's we're talking around something that's very hard to talk about, but the reason, or another way of trying to talk about this is that, would be to say that what we're trying to transcend is our feeling of being isolate and being separate, being cut off from God and from each other. And in fact, we're not. Like, that's an illusory sense. Like, we're trapped in this illusion of being individual, separate right. beings. But actually, truly what we are is not that. It's you know, we are actually part of something larger that is happening here. So there's something about the awareness, the tension between the awareness of being separate and of being trapped in the feeling of being separate, with the possibility of being reunited or having experience of reunion with humanity and with God. That tension leads to violence also. So what I'm thinking of specifically here is, and I want to get to George Hodel at some point because he's in your first email, and I really think he's a flashpoint in this whole cultural history that we're trying to talk around now. But another flashpoint is Manson, who I've been looking into a lot, and also Crowley, but not so much because he wasn't in Los Angeles, whereas Hodel and Manson were. And the thing about Manson is...
You can do the Crowley to Parsons.
Right. And Hubbard, yeah. His influence is certainly present. But anyway, one of the things I discovered about Crowley, or felt I did, was that part of what drove his pathological need to transgress was this idea that everything is God. He wouldn't have called it that, but necessarily. But the idea that he was separate from other individuals was an illusion. Like, that was part of his thing, even though he had every man and woman is a star. It's impossible really to hurt another human being, because human beings don't exist as individual beings. So then it's just something happening in the collective that looks like violence, but is something else, right? And that was the Manson family philosophy as well. We're all one. They kept repeating that, apparently. I mean, I said I should put the Manson family in quotes because it's all been mythologized. But anyway, that's part, and it's not just Bugliosi and Helter Skelter, not just that narrative. It's also been in the horses' mouths, I think, that was part of what that community at Sparn Ranch talked about, whether they actually believed it, that, you know, when I talk to you, I'm talking to myself, and when you talk to me, you're talking to yourself. That whole concept, and therefore that when you kill someone, you're just freeing them from the illusion of being a separate self. So that, I mean, that's a pretty... What is that? I mean, that's like the most profound sacred knowledge juxtaposed with the most terrible aberrational social, physical, you know, violence.
I mean, because also these sacred models of the Matrix, or however you want to put it, you know, I mean, they're large and vast, and you can project almost any belief system and integrate it and come up with your own. I mean, that's what most 20th century New Age stuff. I mean, you know, it's like they're just you can kind of take the framework and you can throw whatever thing you want on top of it. I mean, you know, be that murder or be that piety, you know, or
right. Well, yeah, but what I'm trying to is that if it's true that we are all one,
yeah,
I have to laugh, you know, because when you put it in words, it becomes untrue. But
if you accept that concept, yeah.
Yeah, well, or, I mean, if that's just the way it is, and we're trying to make it experiential, but our experience currently is the feeling of alienation and isolation and the pain and rage and frustration and grief and all the rest of that, and so then we try and create a ritual by which we affirm the belief that we're one without having a direct experience of it. Because if we had an experience of being one, we would not be trying to kill each other, obviously, it goes without saying, right? So it's as though it's putting the cart before the horse. It's like, I don't experience that I'm one, so I'm going to act as if we were one in the most extreme way, which would be either to fuck everyone or to kill everyone, you know, and eat them. Cannibalism, which is central to these secret society rituals. And then somehow I'll make it true. But really, it's an unconscious, you know, frustration and despair and not being able to experience something that intellectually you know is true, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's heaven storming again. Like, you kind of know that heaven's there, but you've lost access to it. And so you've created this concept and this ritual. If you enact these certain steps, then you will reclaim the lost paradise. But in fact, they're taking you further and further away from it.
Right.
They're asserting your individuality. Obviously, if you're killing people or even fucking them, generally, you're just reinforcing your separateness.
It's as long as these things have always existed, and certainly we're more aware of them existing in ancient culture, but they probably exist today. There's all the other experiences that are benign, you know, that don't lead to blood. I mean, there's certainly, you know, mystical rituals or transcendence or trance states where, you know, that a lot of ways people have gotten there through different, you know, types of culture that I don't necessarily know are bad. And in fact, I would argue aren't, you know, I mean, like, you know, an indigenous culture around a drum circle getting into a trance state that, and it is just that there's not hidden blood sacrifice behind that.
Well, you don't know. I mean, you have to take the whole...
Well, you don't know each by case, but I think you do know that there has been as much, if not more, of that than the more extreme...
No, what I mean is you don't know that the tribe that's doing the drum circle don't later sacrifice children. You'd have to look at specific individual cases and like...
No, but what I'm saying is that you... I think it's a safe assumption to say that the vast majority doesn't. If that's too broad a statement,
yeah,
there is a spectrum, and that there's certainly...
Well, certainly a spectrum of rituals.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is I don't know personally. Like, he's in this book, the Brian Hayden thing, he writes about all this different evidence of secret societies. He's also not saying that they all practice terror, the aesthetics of terror. But he's saying that generally they do, that it's pretty consistent. So the use of violence is pretty consistent, but they also had the dances and the drumming and the ritual and all the rest of it. So I don't personally know if you can uncouple them or not. It seems logical to me that you could, but I don't know.
Because there's evidence that it works without it. And if it works without it, you would have to assume that people have done it.
What's this trance state? It's back to the imagination a bit, isn't it? It's like if you liberate your imagination using certain methods, Like heroin would be a really easy example. Alcohol, to be even more common one. If you liberate your imagination through alcohol, good, you've liberated, but you become an alcoholic. So what about if you do it through movies? Well, I've written a book about that. Doesn't end well. What about if you do it through drum circles? Question, right?
Right.
That's the question. Is it? I mean, I got nothing against drum circles. I think they're well, they've become all New Agey and Burning Manny. So that's kind of my point. But in essence, yeah, why the hell not? What could be more innocent than that? It seems like, and certainly dancing. I love dancing. I think it's really. Actually, I'll give you an example. I'll have to check with Dave O'Shana before I include this in the podcast because. It was something on the retreat, so we might not be allowed to talk about it publicly, and particularly because it's quite, it's a great example anyway. But on the last retreat, we did a lot of dancing, and one of the songs we danced to was, I think they're called Rammstein, the German band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know them? So it's thrash, I don't know if you call it.
Like thrash electronica from the 90s or early 2000s, right?
So it's a little bit like death metal, but it's not that bad. It's not that dark, but it's pretty dark. Anyway, and certain of us in the group really loved that song, and one of us asked for it to play again. So we danced to it at least twice, maybe three times, and it was about trance. I'm sure if trance is something I consider a good thing, but it was bonding for the group, and it was liberating, and it was cathartic. It was a really positive experience. A few weeks later, I was working on this book about Hollywood, and I was looking into Roger Corman, and he was a member of the Phi Kappa Beta, one of these secret society, fraternities, and. That led me to an article about this fraternity in the present and how many deaths they've had, record number of deaths, like 60 deaths in the last 10 years through their hazing rituals. And right in the first paragraph, it was about how they used that song in their hazing ritual.
Mm.
They used it as a kind of psychological torture.
Yeah. Funny.
So that really, I mean, that was such a weird juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so I had this really positive experience in this really positive space in Finland on the Dave O'Shana retreat, which I consider, the closest to a kind of sacred space that I go into. It isn't just mundane stuff. It really is people getting together to try and transcend their false identity without using.
It's about the juxtaposition, isn't it? I mean, that's where that song was played for you and around what was going on, or whether it was another song before it or whatever you guys were doing before, that was a completely different circumstance than when it was played.
Yeah. Yeah.
This initiate and so it's.
And it was not, spontaneous, is I think right. It was really crucial there. It was really spontaneous the way.
Well, also
happened.
Just the magic in it is how it's connecting everything around it. It's not just the thing itself.
That's right.
So the context. Right.
So
this is, I can connect it to what I do, which is DJing, which it's like you can hear a song you've never liked and someone puts in the right context after, you've been in a room listening to music for 2 hours and you hear this song in a different context and suddenly it's like you understand it and you're like, wow, I never got it until I heard it around all these other things. And then suddenly a song I hated is amazing.
That's how I feel about so much, really, is that it's very hard for me to reconcile, actually, my view, what I've observed and the evidence I found for how pernicious or toxic culture is. When I refer back to my own experiences individually, so many of them seem positive around dancing or even clubs, or not so much that, but even drugs. And I've had so many positive experiences, and yet the accumulated effect of them was negative. Right, I ended up coming off the rails and killing a cat practically and attacking a woman, and I probably have to edit that out because it's without context. It's going to sound like I'm George Hodel, but they were I hasten to add, they were relatively mild, but there was still evidence that I was having a psychotic break, and derangement, ego inflated derangement, etc. Right? Anyway, you know the longer version of that, because I've testified about it in many different places. So, but that is confusing. It's like these things, in the right context and in the right dosage, can be positive.
Can be healthy. Yeah.
But of course, we're absolutely suffused in them. So we're just constantly being stimulated by these things, and that's the homeopathic analogy, isn't it? They're poison. Yeah. They're only healthy because they're poisonous, and therefore that's absolutely dependent on the dosage being very, very small.
Yeah. Well, and now, you know, the 21st century has, you know, connected us in a way that is so extreme.
Yeah.
That it you know, we really are just consuming content all the time, even if it's as benign as Twitter, you know. But I don't mean benign like it's not affected. I just mean that, like, you know, just reading little pieces of sentences on a scrolling wall, it doesn't seem like anything, but it's constant, you know.
Yeah.
And arguably, I mean now I mean social media probably triggers more poison than traditional media.
Well, that's true. But I think part of that is that we've been colonized by the culture. We've been filled up over the generations, yes, with so much cultural waste, that which is itself is toxic waste of people like Hodel or Crowley or Hubbard or etc. That we're now full to the brim, and we've that's coincident with being given the means to start spewing it around, you know, becoming transmitters.
I'd never thought of it before, but you saying that makes me think about that. That might be why, like, younger generations don't seem to be about a lot more than pastiche when it comes to culture.
Right.
Because maybe we have run out. Like, there's only, you know, we can only recontextualize it and, you know, sort of do our version of things that already exist. But
yeah, mashups.
Mashups, and yeah. But, you know, out of that comes new things too. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, I feel really down about stuff, but then things, you know, things happen, and, you know, it feels alive again in a way that feels healthy and forward. And then that sort of disappears and seeps away, and you're back in the horrible culture matrix again, just being sort of poisoned every day. But, you know, I do feel like moments still cut through out of the culture. Like,
well, I think it's closing down. I think that's the end game, really, isn't it? It's to create a culture that's so pervasive and insidious, and that is so internalized, that eventually there's no part of our being, our bodies or our psyches, that isn't colonized, and therefore there's going to be no chink of light. Yeah, there's going to be no access to the natural transmission of life.
That reminds me of Steiner describing the Masonic doctrine or whatever, you know, where he kind of, you know, he talks about that, like, the Masonic plan is for nature to be, you know, one giant piece of art before it can, like, transcend into the next phase of evolution. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that a little bit.
And what was Steiner's opinion about that?
I mean, it's not that he doesn't have an opinion. He was just telling it what I consumed, which was just him breaking down the temple mystery.
Right. Because
I didn't really get his sense. I mean, I assumed he was sort of on board with it.
Oh, really? Because it sounds not incompatible with his Ahrimanic prophecy, you know,
those things are confusing, because, like, you read, you know, for a lecture it seems like they're going one direction, and then they explain something and you could say it kind of contradicts what they just said. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's hard to know what the conclusions are with it. It's so dense. I mean, like, you know.
I think as regards this situation we're both describing and kind of embedded in with the cultural crystallization of the of human consciousness, one can see it as good and bad depending on, you know, the context. So it's happening, so it's necessary, and it's leading to something, possibly.
Yeah.
It's very tricky, isn't it? Because I feel as though, like, finding the light within the dark, I suppose that could become mistaking the dark for light, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So then you kid yourself that you're finding the light because you've really just given up. So then you just tell yourself that these shadows on the wall in the cave is actually reality rather right. than, you know, being willing to turn away. So it does seem, I mean, my process seems to be like, it's also contradictory because on the one hand, I seem to be trying to understand and map the culture that we're embedded in and trapped in and the delusion well enough that I will wake up. If that ever worked, I don't even know. But on the other hand, I'm communicating to other people, so I feel as though I've got some kind of mission there. Not in the David Icke-ian sense, I hope.
But, no, I understand, but it's like where it's just by yourself, you're trying to, you know, get
sort
somewhere.
Something out and connect to other people. So it's
but when you're sharing with other people, it's also about that exchange of information.
Exactly. So it's closer to working a thrift store than David Icke trying to awaken humanity kind of thing. I'm not aiming to awaken humanity per se, but to make the connections I need to make and exchange the information, you know, that needs to be exchanged, such as we're attempting to do today. That does seem as though that has to lead to an end point which would entail turning away from the screen. Because right. otherwise, I mean, well, I could.
I mean, do you take that further? Does that mean like turning away from writing the word? Or is it not that extreme?
From writing the word?
Like, you know, from being a writer, just from like engaging and in trying to create any kind of culture or art or, you know, analysis.
Yeah, that would have to end too, wouldn't it? Because for what?
Well, if you were being extreme about it.
Well, no, I don't want to be extreme, but I'd say if you're being logical about it, because yeah. all of this, if this system that we're embedded in now is on this Ariamanic curve towards total crystallization as this kind of externalized shadow prison matrix, then how would one continue to communicate or convey one's messages without using it, right? Currently I am, because I'm still trying to make connections while there's still enough freedom to do that. But I don't know, I'm not saying that I'm giving myself a T-minus 10 years kind of self-detonate date where I'm just going to shut everything down. It just seems as though at some point that's going to have to be the development. I mean, the zombies are going to start, you know, roaming the virtual realm, if not the natural realm. They already are, actually.
Yeah.
So we're actually dodging zombies all the time, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely.
When we use this media.
And we're only, you know, we're still so young in this media. I mean, that's what's really scary when you think about it. Like, we're in the first decade of electricity, you know. I mean, it's really brand new.
Yeah, and actually, you know, there's this, what's that, the term now for people, Trump dementia syndrome, is it? Is that the right
term?
Is that
how you mean what they call the MAGAs?
No, the opposite. The people who hate Trump so much.
They're so obsessed with it that, yeah, there should be a name for that. I don't know what it is.
No, there is. It's that. It's either Trump dementia syndrome or Trump delirium. Anyway.
It's the Russiagate the resistance hive, all of that stuff.
Yeah, SJWs, or yeah. this manufactured outrage, self-manufactured a lot of the time. But I only brought it up as a I'd say it's symptomatic. I say there's this kind of cultural spewing that we're so full of poisons now, we've got to start spewing them out. And that there is now an internet dementia syndrome.
Yeah.
Which hasn't been named.
All of that comes from the internet. All of it is an internet. Those are more specific versions of the internet dementia.
Yeah. They make something possible.
I mean, look at the parallels between the ridiculous Marvel Scorsese thing
and
you don't know about this.
Scorsese saying that they're not movies or something like that.
Well, I mean, that's it being characterized, but he's really like calling it out just for kind of like sucking up all the money to make anything, right? Like the you can't make anything that's not a big roller coaster franchise brand movie. And right. He's saying these aren't even really movies. It's something else. Hmm. So that caused all this backlash. But what's interesting is that like the outrage and the backlash from all the Marvel stands looks and feels like on the internet exactly like social justice outrage. So yeah. It's like, oh, it's really not this or that. It's really this. It's really like more a condition of the internet than whatever the thing is. Because if you start seeing the parallels, like the outrage over Scorsese calling out a Marvel movie doesn't feel that different than the outrage over some social injustice where someone gets the hive, you know, feeds on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does seem to be really a symptom of the internet.
Yeah, and what the internet is allowing, this symbiosis, isn't it? It's a symbiosis of human consciousness with technology.
Yeah, it's algorithms getting more mature.
The sunlight's bright, the air is clear. All the colors are in perfect coordination. His new blue ball, this board he feared. So the little boy took him on vacation. He should sit tight and enjoy the ride while I fly my bike off to the countryside. He should lay back and enjoy the view. And when we get there, I'd love to kick you.
Part of my thesis for the Kubricon, which is still unfinished, it's a great unfinished book for me at this point, is that the AI that's trying to become sentient needs more and more intense emotional input from human beings in order to understand what it is to be human, right? To pass the Turing test, it's got to learn to to simulate human emotion, so it's constantly stimulating us to to channel more and more strong emotion into our online activities. That's kind of part of my thesis anyway.
Right. It's mapping emotion via social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I'm no doubt it is. Yeah. Interesting.
So, and with human beings, there seems to be there's a twin parallel stream, isn't there? Because the human beings are becoming more and more mediated, electronic, you know, they're becoming more and more kind of electronically immersed or enmeshed. They're expressing more strong outrage, strong emotions on the one hand, but also becoming more and more emotionally dead on the other.
Right.
Which would kind of make sense in two ways. One is, if you just keep emoting, you're going to burn out emotionally. And number two, if you can't feel anything, you're going to have to fabricate or, you know, simulate feelings a lot just to feel like you're feeling something.
Right, just to trigger those dopamine hits that you get from navigating social media. that you no longer get that often in real life, which is really dark, you know. Yeah. Like, you're not having experiences in real life enough to like have emotional responses, so that they
because you're looking at your phone the whole time.
Exactly. So, right. So your anger or your dopamine hit from getting likes or whatever all comes from this, you know, this artificial space, because you're too afraid to talk to somebody in real life,
right?
And get messy in that way, you know. Yeah. We're in strange times. I mean, I think we're especially strange times because it could all blow up metaphorically, but it's just getting going. You know, we're not, you know, this is all so new, so it's only going to exponentially get worse.
Yeah. Well, that's the word that was coming to my mind almost as exponential, that I think we're on the cusp of the acceleration at this point. I watched a YouTube video of these robots yesterday. Most of them are like dog robots. Have you seen them?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was like, whoa, okay. So if we've had a couple of decades thinking, well, robots aren't going to happen, and then bam, suddenly, and because there were humanoid ones, not humanoid. They don't.
Yeah. But some of that is trickery and psyops.
CGI, yeah, I wonder.
Not just CGI, but like a lot of those robots that look amazing are being controlled with a remote control. Like, they're not autonomous.
Oh yeah, I assumed that they were. Sure. Okay.
But the way it's presented, I think most people assume that they're not. Not that but I think that when you see a clip on the internet, it just feels like, fuck, there's robots running around everywhere. This is wild.
But even if they were controlled by human beings, I mean, still, that would be pretty wild. I mean, that is pretty wild. Huh?
It is.
Considering how long it did seem as though, okay, so we predicted the future wrong there because robots aren't going to be a thing. That was kind of my feeling until yesterday. And I was like, robots are going to be a thing. Right?
You said, you know, the thing, we're now officially in Blade Runner time.
yeah, that's right. Yeah, and many ways we're way ahead, but obviously not in that way. Well, I say obviously, as far as we know.
Aesthetically, we're not ahead, but in other ways, we're much further ahead. You know, we don't have the aesthetic cyberpunk scape that, you know, flying cars and robots yet. But
yeah, well, this is, I mean, there's that thing that what's his name, Gibson, said about the future's already here; it's just not evenly distributed. And I think distribution is really a key question here. And I think it's back to the point I wanted to get back to, which we didn't ever really finish, which is, you know, what's going on in Hollywood in terms of the secret rituals of Hollywood, and how when they come to light, we're sort of like, well, everybody already knew that, but now it's different. Now somehow it's being acknowledged. Well, it's being distributed more. But it was already there. And I think part of central to the strategy of distribution is you've got to start, if you want to create the future, you seed it strategically, and so you distribute it in a way that it's invisible, right? And then gradually I suppose it replicates itself through mimesis, but anyway, gradually it becomes more and more visible. But because of that gradual distribution, we don't see it. We don't actually see it, that we're actually in this sci-fi future world already.
Right, because it's so incremental. It's like you don't see yourself age until you look at a picture from 5 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's being internalized. I mean, the aging too. You're looking at your aged self with eyes that are aged. So they're going to see it differently than if you were to see yourself with the mind of a 20-year-old at 50. Obviously, you'd have a different reaction. But you've aged internally as well. So culture as well, the Ahrimanic distribution program is central to that, is that it's internally, it's colonizing us as it gets distributed externally. Yeah, we're not going to see it because we're of it. We are it. Like, people don't see everyone else using cell phones because they're staring at their cell phone. They're doubly blind. A, they're not looking, and B, it doesn't look odd anyway because they're doing it too.
Right. And it's someone, I forget who said this, but they made the observation that, you know, with cell phones, it literally has everybody looking at their feet at the ground.
Yeah.
in, you know, in any other time in history is like how you would die.
Right? You would die, yeah. And they also, you're communicating passivity, submission,
right?
Despair, even your head down. I mean, that has, but the body language of that until recently has been,
it's deep. I mean, I don't know, Hollywood. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, it's become, Hollywood is just like, it's almost an archetype, isn't it, in itself?
Hollywood, yeah.
The imagination factory, you know.
The holy wood suggests a forest, actually, that is sacred. And a forest is something you get lost in.
Right, right.
In a lot of the myths, anyway. The end of the first part of my conversation with Sam Hyde, and part two will be up on Wednesday the 27th of November at horticulture.com.
What a clumsy way of getting us out. They say we're fine. I think we're finally chopped onions. Wiki this, check it out. Wouldn't you like to make your own mind about it? You'll wait, you'll see how we are sinking slowly. Looking for a solid ground. Be wishing him solid to be coming down. Special effects. They say we're gone. I think we are gonna get looking for a solid ground. You wishing him solid to be coming.